Okay, so on slide one, before the lecture begins, well, this is a lecture on how to make Pong, so turn in what you have with the Pong thing. I know it's a little tough, especially for beginning people, and maybe I should have done the slide before the Pong thing started, but if you haven't made Pong yet, I hope this will help you, and maybe after this lecture you'll be more prepared to make Pong, and I apologize if that is the case. Secondly, today I compiled the framework for Visual C++ 6.0 in the version, not the Learning Edition, so it should work with just about any compiler on the market now. And I fixed most of the bugs and errors that have cropped up, so I'm pretty sure this will work with everyone's compiler, and you can test for yourself if that's the case by downloading it from the website on slide number one. The http://pclx.com/itcc. And if that gives you any problems, please post in the forums, but I highly doubt that it will if you set it up right. And I'll post more instructions on how to set it up right later tonight. Oh, we have an help I cannot connect. So let's see if we can help this guy out. Or can you guys actually help him out in the chat room here? Okay, so I'm going to say, yeah, why don't you guys help him out in the chat room, and then I'm just going to continue on to slide two. So this is an introduction to C++, lecture number four already, and I decided to slow down a little and just go into a review of Pong here for people who couldn't get it or for people wanting sort of a different perspective on how they might want to do things. Okay, it looks like Wesman2k is getting some help there, file play URL, and if he gets in the next few seconds here, I'll see if I can wait. And so I guess I'll keep on talking just for a second. Okay, I guess that's not a good sign. So I'll just go on to slide three, and hopefully he can be helped out in the chat room. Okay, so how do I make a game? So a game usually has a lot of standard parts to it. And these are some of the common parts you might see in a game. It might have initialization and then shutdown at the very end. So at the beginning it'll do initialization, at the end it'll do shutdown. If we actually go to slide number four, we can see all of this laid out in a really nice flowchart I made. So the first thing we'll do at the program start is to initialize everything. And initialize might be allocating memory, setting up variables to be the right things, everything you might want to do right when you start the game. And then we have something called the game loop. And the game loop is looped through every single frame. And actually, in modern games, we might have lots of game loops going on at once, like one to get the input, one to render graphics, one to render music. A lot of different stuff going on, but for our intents and purposes, we're just going to have one game loop that does everything. So often the first thing you'll do in a game loop is to gather user input, and then you might render some graphics, then you might perform some logic, and then you might go all the way back to user input. Now in reality, there are a lot more things that you can segment this game loop into. For example, you might put in some AI in the perform logic. You might have, in the perform logic, move the ball around the screen. And you can actually split this up even more to add, you know, render music. You can do a lot of things in the game loop, because that's actually what's going on inside the game. And later on in this course, we're actually going to partition up the game loop into a lot more segments. And a lot of things called states that the game loop might be in. For example, if you see a main menu, then you might still go through this same process, but you'll take a different branch than you would if you're rendering the entire screen at once. And then finally, once we're finished with the game loop, then we're going to exit the loop and go down to shutdown. And shutdown will involve releasing our resources back to the computing machine. So if we allocate a bunch of memory for use in our game, then we're going to free it. And this is pretty much the standard loop that goes into every game, and including our Pong. And in fact, if you look at the Pong solution that I posted, then you'll see that I kind of split it up into these parts. There's an initialization phase, there's a user input phase, there's a render graphics phase, and then the perform logic phase. And you can see sort of how all of those fit together. And so in slide 5, like I said earlier, this lecture will mainly go over how Pong was made. So if you go to the website and download the Pong solution I posted, you can sort of follow along in the code. I'm just going to try to go through my thought processes as I wrote Pong. And this is a pretty simple game to make if you're a more advanced programmer, but it's one of the easiest you can make graphically and have it, you know, be pretty cool and make you feel like you've accomplished something. So first of all, where do we begin? So I think the fun part of making a game like Pong is the graphics. And to answer one of the questions, any reason why you would choose this order of logic? I just put those phases there arbitrarily, honestly. And in fact, in the Pong game that I put on the web, I have user input last and render graphics first. So it's really arbitrary, but these are just phases that can really be performed in any order. And in fact, you might exit the loop at any time in the loop. You might exit it even in the user input phase, not necessarily at the end. It might all be done in a random order. So like M said, it doesn't really matter. Just whatever works in your game. Sometimes it might be that you have to do one first to satisfy other things or to make sure that all of your variables are in the right bounds or something. For example, in the Pong game, if you don't test the bounds of your paddles at the very beginning of the game loop, then you might have initialized them to bad values, and that might crash your program. But you might always want to perform the logic after the user inputs something, for instance, because that might cause the paddle to go off the screen too. And when you render the graphics, then it might go off the screen. So, you know, juggling everything around, whatever works best for your program is probably the best order. So back to slide 5. I did a little brainstorm there about, you know, what we need to draw for the game. And these are normally called game assets. Normally an artist would sit down and have to make these game assets. And a lot of game making is the construction of assets, like art, like sound, like music, like all the multimedia stuff that goes into the game that the programmer doesn't make. But in this case, Pong's pretty simple, so the programmer can actually draw everything to the screen at once. So, in my little brainstorm here, I determined that we're going to need a ball, we're going to need two paddles, and then, just for fun, I'm going to put in some upper and lower screen boundaries, because those will probably be the easiest to draw to start off with. So in slide 6, I'm going to start with drawing the screen boundaries. So I decided to choose the easiest thing to draw first, just to motivate myself to continue, because I was pretty sure I'd get this right away. And why are these so easy? Because they don't move at all throughout the game. Every single frame I'm going to be drawing the same screen boundaries. And by screen boundaries I just mean I'm going to be drawing a dashed line at the very top and the very bottom of the screen, so that we can see where the ball is going to bounce off of. And I just made it dashed just for fun. It could be solid or whatever. So in slide 7, let's see how we're going to construct these screen boundaries. So, I think that I might just try the whiteboard. So let me see if I can log on to the whiteboard here. Can anyone not connect to the whiteboard, by the way? Because if they can't, then we can use something else. because I think the whiteboard might be a good thing, because I didn't include many images in the slides this time. I probably should have to illustrate some more concepts. So can everyone connect to this? I'm going to type that in. pclx.com/itcc/whiteboard.html. Can anyone not connect? If someone can't connect, then I might just try to explain it a little more verbally. So it looks like we have one person who can't connect. So, okay, I'll just do this verbally. Okay, so looking at slide number, let me go here again, slide number 7, let's take a look and decipher this for statement. So we figured out that, first of all, we have some variable that I named xIndex. And so initially, right before we get to this for loop, we're going to set the xIndex variable equal to 0. So this xIndex thing is going to be sort of a counter. It's going to count which iteration through the loop we're at. So that's the first part of the for statement there. We set xIndex equal to 0. So the second part of the for loop is our condition that we're looking at. So we're saying if this counter variable, the xIndex, is less than the x resolution of the screen, which is 640, so remember the pixel boundaries again, xres is equal to 640, so we can't render a pixel to the location 640 on the screen. 639 is the highest value, or the highest coordinate that we can render a pixel to, because we go from the coordinate 0, 0, to the coordinate 639, comma 0, because the numbers 1 through 639 are 639 plus 0 make a total length of 640. So if we try rendering a pixel to the screen coordinate 640, it's going to cause an error. And now, finally, to the last part of the for statement, to make the line dotted, I'm going to increment the variable, the counter, xIndex, by 2 every time. So I'll skip over. So I'll be counting by 2s from 0 to 639. So, let's not try to be too distracted by the whiteboard here. Maybe I just shouldn't have put that up. So, we are counting from 0 to 639, and now let's take a look inside our for loop. So we're setting two pixels on the screen. One at the top of the screen, look at the y coordinate there, it has the 0, and one at the bottom of the screen, at yres minus 1. So if yres is 480, that's 479. And it's 479 again, because if we put one at 480, that's going to give us an error, because 0 through 479 is 480 pixels. And then the third thing to notice is that I used a variable here instead of an RGB32 macro. I used screen bound color. So let's take a look at slide number 8 and see how I declared these variables. So first of all, we have the standard X resolution and Y resolution at 640 by 480. Secondly, I declared the counter variable xIndex, and I set it equal to 0. And then lastly, I made the screen bound color variable as an unsigned long, and I packed it into that red equal to 0, green equal to 255, and blue equal to 255, and that produces cyan. So hopefully that is a pretty good explanation of how the screen boundaries are drawn. Does anyone not understand what's going on, or needs any more help with that? Okay, so let's go on to drawing the ball. So in slide number 9, we're going to try to draw the ball. So if you look at this code, first of all, I haven't used really any numbers except for 0. So Again, I have x index, but this time I have a second for loop, a nested for loop, which has a y index. So now we're going to draw the ball from the upper left coordinate of the ball, and this is just defined arbitrarily. So my x ball comma y ball coordinates is going to be the upper left part of the ball. So x index is just a counter variable going from 0 to ball height, minus 1. Y index is the same, and I decided to make my ball square. So I'm going to set a pixel at the coordinate x ball plus x index and y ball plus y index. So this coordinate is going to change, and notice that I'm going to be drawing it in columns. So the first thing I'll do is make the left column, then I'm going to make the second to left column, then the third to left column. And how do you know I'm drawing it in columns? Because my inner for loop is the y coordinate. So I'm incrementing the y coordinate, and the x coordinate isn't changing. So that means that I'm drawing it in columns. Wesman asked whether it's skipping by 2 pixels each time, and it's actually skipping a single pixel every time. So if we start out, and this is in drawing the screen boundaries, so if we start out by, and this is on slide 7, if we start out as at x index equal to 0, then the next time x index will equal 2, so we skip the number 1. The time after that, x index will equal 4, so we skip the number 3. So as you can see, we actually light every other pixel. Alright, back to slide number 9. So with these two for loops in place, we're going to just draw it column by column. We're going to just draw a bunch of pixels, column by column by column. And we're drawing the columns ball height tall and ball height wide. So this will draw a square ball. And you'll have to experiment some more if you want to find out some more about how that works. So if you maybe take out the inner for loop, see that it draws a horizontal line. If you take out the outer for loop, it'll draw a column. So just some things to play around with. If we go to slide 10 now, we're going to see how we can draw the paddles. So to draw the paddles are drawn exactly like the balls are. The only difference is that my paddles have a width and they have a height, and the width and height are different from each other, with a ball that's symmetric. So I have a paddle width variable and a paddle height variable, and notice that the width is associated with the x, and the height is associated with the y. And again, I'm going to be drawing 2 pixels every frame, one for the paddle on the left and one for the paddle on the right. So you can see how that works out, how I change the positions. Notice I have variables called x paddle left, x paddle right, and that's the x coordinate for the paddle on the left and the x coordinate for the paddle on the right. And if I execute this code, it's going to draw 1 pixel of my rectangular paddle on the left, and then it's going to draw 1 pixel of the rectangular paddle on the right. And again, notice that we're drawing it column by column. If you make it really slow motion, you'll see this, but that's pretty tough to do. So because our inner for loop is the y-index. Now if we swapped all the y-index for loop with the x-index for loop, if we swapped all the y and x-index indices and the paddle width and paddle height, then we'd be drawing it row by row. And in some instances, row by row is probably a little faster, but not in this one. And so something else I wanted you to see is how we can define all of our variables, the x paddle left, the y paddle left, just how we can calculate the initial position of these paddles, because I want the paddles centered in the screen. So if we take a look at the left paddle, I have this variable called x paddle from edge, which is the width in between the paddle and the edge of the screen. So the leftmost X value of my paddle is going to be that far away from the edge. And then the Y value, I want this centered along the Y axis. So if I take the whole Y range, which is Y res, and I divided that by 2, and then that puts me in the direct center of the screen. Now imagine that I have a paddle, which is paddle height tall, and I divide that by 2. That'll put me in the exact center of the paddle. So if I find the exact center of the screen and subtract half the height of a paddle from that, then that'll give me the position of the upper left-hand corner of my paddle. You see how that works? I'm taking the total Y resolution and halving it. That puts me in the center of the height of the screen. And then from that, I'm subtracting half of the height of the paddle. And that gives me half of the height of the paddle. So if I'm taking the center of the screen minus half of the paddle length. And that puts me at the upper left-hand corner of my paddle. So I can draw it then. In graphics, it's pretty customary to define sprites and images and everything by their upper left corner. And that's just arbitrary, though. You can actually define them by any. But you'll see why the upper left-hand corner might be your best bet. We have another question, that the columns would be faster in this instance. So back, in slide 10 still, the columns aren't going to be any faster, since we're going to be setting the same number of pixels per paddle. But there are optimizations that you can use to make rows draw faster on the screen, because it turns out that the pixels in memory are actually right after each other in memory, according to the row. So if a pixel is immediately to the right of another pixel, you can actually kind of optimize that in your code and make it a little faster, because you don't have to go anywhere, really. You can just say, write a pixel here, then immediately after that write this pixel, immediately after that write that pixel. So that's usually a little faster if you write it right than going by the column, because you can't really make many optimizations going down a column. So, slide number 11. So what I decided to do next after I had these graphics down, basically what I've done so far is pretty cool. So just as a quick recap, in slide 7 I drew the screen boundaries in the same place every single frame. In slide 8, that's still the boundaries. In slide 9, what this little piece of code does is that it draws the ball at any position on the screen that I want to. All I have to do is set the variables X ball and Y ball to be where I want to draw the ball on the screen, and it'll automatically draw it. So that's really cool. In slide 10, I did the same thing with the paddles. I have X paddle left, comma, Y paddle left, and that's the position to draw my paddle on the screen. So no matter what values I put in for those two variables, it's going to draw a paddle at that location on the screen. And that's really what we need here. I need to be able to draw a paddle and a ball anywhere on the screen I want to. So that's sort of what I've set up to this point with the graphics. So on slide number 11, now what I'm going to do is I need to keep my paddles inside the screen, or else it's going to give me that error that I'm drawing outside of the screen boundaries. So how am I going to keep my paddles inside the screen? Well, this is back to our if statements that we've been talking about. Remember how we started out with if statements saying, if the key is down, then do this. Well, now I'm going to be putting variables into my if statements. So if the y-coordinate of my left paddle, remember the y-coordinate is how far from the top of the screen the paddle is. So if the left paddle's y-coordinate rises above the top of the screen, well, my set pixel routine can't draw above the screen, or it'll give me an error. Or even worse, it'll shut down my program. So what I need to do here is, if my paddle goes above this, then I need to set the top left corner of my paddle to be right there at the top edge of the screen. Because I can't draw stuff above the top of the screen. It just won't let me. Plus, that would look kind of weird to the user. So I'm going to do that for the left paddle. I'm going to do that for the right paddle. And also note, what if my user input section is after this test to see whether my paddles are inbound? This goes back to someone's question they had earlier, actually, as to, you know, does the order of these game logic blocks matter? Well, if I do the user input after I perform this inbound paddle logic, then they might actually move the paddle up beyond the screen coordinates, so I could get a set pixel error, even though my paddles are tightly controlled and tightly inbound with this. So I need to make sure that I get the input and I change the paddle location right before I check to see if the paddles are inbound. And secondly, I do the same thing where if the paddle tries to go below the bottom of the screen, I need to set it so that it's right at the bottom of the screen. And how I do this is, I know that the upper left-hand corner of my paddle is at a certain location called Y paddle left and Y paddle right, and I need to test to see whether this is greater than or equal the total Y resolution minus the total height of the paddle. And if you think about that, that'll set us back to a screen coordinate, kind of up the screen a little, that is right before it's the upper left-hand coordinate of the paddle, and it's right before we leave the bottom of the screen. So it's the same thing going on here. We're just going to constrain the paddle so it can't leave the screen at all. So on slide 12, how are we going to move the ball? This is a big question that was brought up. You know, I mean, if I just use X ball plus plus Y ball plus plus, that's going to move the ball in a diagonal direction. It's going to move it down and right in a diagonal direction. And the problem is, you know, I have X ball plus plus and Y ball plus plus, and it's just going to go off the screen. How do I change that? Well, there are actually a billion different ways of changing it. But one of the best that I've discovered is to actually have a few velocities. So I'm going to have a variable that holds the X ball velocity. I'm going to have a variable that holds the Y ball velocity. And every single frame, I'm going to increment the X ball position by the X ball velocity. So here, it's important to note, so what if the velocity is greater than zero? Well, then the ball is going to move to the right. What if the velocity is zero? Then the ball is going to stay in a certain place, and it's not going to move. And what if the ball is less than zero? Well, then the coordinate X ball will count down, and the ball will move to the left of the screen. So this is a pretty powerful way of trying to tell my ball whether to move to the right, to the left, so I can have it bounce all over the place. And that's what's important with using this method. All I'll have to change to make it bounce around is that X ball velocity. And this addition will automatically happen. So down to slide 13. So I'm playing the game horizontally. I have a paddle on the left and a paddle on the right. And I want the ball to bounce around. Most importantly, I want it to bounce off the top of the screen, and I want it to bounce off the bottom of the screen. So, and I told you, you might have to flip back to slide 12, back and forth. In this case, I have ball speed equal to 1. So the speed of the ball is 1 pixel per frame. If you want to call that a velocity, it's 1 pixel per frame times 1 frame equals how many pixels the ball moves. So if the Y coordinate of the ball goes higher or equal to the top of the screen, then we're going to change the Y ball velocity so that it goes down the screen instead of up, because we can't have the ball going outside of the screen boundary. So this is, here again is our if statement. So if the y coordinate of the ball tries to go higher than the screen, then we need to set the velocity of the ball to be positive, so that the ball goes downward. So immediately the ball's going to be moving up, 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 and we're going to change the speed of the ball so that it deflects and goes down. And then I'm using the else if, because both of these can't be true. They're exactly opposites, depending on the values of the variables, of course. But now, what if the ball is trying to go below the bottom of the screen? And this is very similar to what we did for constraining the paddles, right? We have the total Y resolution of the screen, and then we subtract the ball height, and this gives us the upper left corner of the ball. This is what we're doing all the time. We're finding the upper left corner of the ball. So if this upper left corner is about to leave the screen, we need to say, uh-oh, we need to change the ball's velocity so that it goes down the screen. And in the case of the Y coordinates, this is giving it a negative velocity so that it goes up. Because remember, the top row of the screen is Y equals 0. And the bottom row is y equals some positive number. So if we subtract from that positive number, we approach 0. So that means it gets closer and closer to the top of the screen. So we do this for the top and the bottom, the first if statement and then the second else if. So if we go to slide 14, this is the really tricky part. Now we have a paddle at the left side of the screen, and we have a paddle on the right side of the screen. And we need not only determine whether the ball hits the left side of the screen or the right side of the screen, but we also have to determine whether the ball is also hitting a paddle. This might be one of the trickiest parts of the code. This is probably one of the trickiest parts of the Pong game to figure out, because this is sort of compound if statements. So if we go to slide 15, let's analyze this line by line. First of all, now this first line here, this is only for the left paddle, by the way. So now remember, I'm looking at the leftmost part, the left upper part of the ball. Okay, and that's X ball, comma Y ball. So here I'm testing the X coordinate, so I'm testing the column that the ball is on. So here, just like I was with the Y ball, with the Y coordinates, I need to see whether my ball's even in the same line, vertical line, that the paddle's in. So if the X ball coordinate, the upper left-hand coordinate of the ball, is less than... Okay, now imagine this. We have the X paddle left is the upper left-hand portion of the paddle. So if I add on the paddle width to that, then that gives me the rightmost line of the paddle. That gives me the rightmost X coordinate of the paddle. And now I'm going to subtract 1 because I want to test this when the ball is 1 pixel into the paddle. And that's so that if the game stops, I can say... the ball is clearly inside the zone and you couldn't have gotten it. But you can just ignore the minus 1 from now because it'll work even without that. So I'm saying if the upper left-hand corner of the ball ever touches the rightmost portion of the paddle, then, if we go back to slide 14, I'm going to test whether it hit the paddle or not. So let's take a look at this tricky if statement back on slide 15. So now, this is how we do ranges. We want to test to see whether the ball is in a certain range on the screen. So if we look at, this is a compound if statement, and the and operator on the lower left, that signifies an and. So I'm testing to see if the top condition is true and the bottom condition is true. Now, if you didn't know about the double and, you could also accomplish this by using a nested if statement. So you could try saying, if the top statement's true, then inside those braces you could say, if the bottom statement's true, then do this. So it's not really a big deal that we haven't gotten to the double ampersand yet. Okay, so let's try to analyze this. So the Y position of the ball is the upper left position of the ball. Now, what I'm doing here is to do a range, I need to test to see whether the Y position of the ball is greater than the top of the paddle and it's less than the bottom of the paddle. If this is true, if both of those statements are true, if it's greater than the top of the paddle and less than the bottom of the paddle, we know that the ball must be somewhere inside the paddle and that it hit the paddle. So the top line of the if statement. So we're taking the y position the of the upper left-hand corner of the left paddle, and we're subtracting the ball height. So imagine this is in the y plane. This is in the y direction here. So we're moving up and down the paddle. So we start out at the top of the paddle, which is y paddle left, and then we go up some more for the ball height, because even if the upper left-hand corner of the ball is a little above the paddle, it can still hit because the bottom of the ball can hit the paddle. So we're just doing a little adjustment for this with the top if statement. Now for the second part of the if statement, we are again going to the upper left-hand portion of the paddle, which is y paddle left, and then we're adding on the paddle height. So we go all the way to the bottom of the paddle. And that's the bottom of the paddle. So we're testing to see whether the upper left-hand corner of the ball reaches this bottom portion of the paddle. And if both of these conditions are true, if it's greater than the top of the paddle and less than the bottom of the paddle, then we know that the ball must have hit and that it has to bounce off. So if we go back to slide 14, if that if statement is true, then the ball must have hit the paddle. So we're going to change the ball's velocity so that it'll deflect and move to the right side of the screen. If this isn't true, if it didn't hit the paddle, then we're going to stop the game and we're going to declare that the right player won because the ball snuck past the left player and it didn't hit his paddle. And another little thing that I did that you'll have to look in my source code for is that isRunning variable. If isRunning is true, then the loop will continue, and if isRunning is false, then the loop will stop, and the program will exit. It's that simple. And that's something that's commonly used in games too. Okay, so we just got finished with how the ball can bounce off the paddle. And that's a big bite, and I encourage you to look over that and see how it works, kind of, because that's kind of confusing. And if you're kind of motivated, maybe you can reproduce this for the right paddle too, just to see if you understand the concepts, or at least how to copy some of this code and reuse it. So in slide 16, this is the easy part. We're just going to get user input. If the user presses the A key, then the left paddle is going to move up the screen. If the user presses the Z key, the paddle is going to move down the screen. Very simple. And I'm directly controlling the paddle variables here. Something that would be even better than this method actually is to, instead of just incrementing or decrementing it by one, to have a variable that says, the paddle should move this many pixels every time the user hits a key. That would be even better because, again, we want to eliminate all the constants inside our code so that's easy for someone to read it. And finally, if you press the escape key, then I'm going to again say that isRunning is false so that the program exits. Okay, moving on to slide 17. Here's just some miscellaneous things that I've included. I also posted these on the message boards. By the way, if you ever look at the message boards, I posted a lot of tips for homework too in the homework section of the message boards. So if you look in the homework section of the message boards, there are lots of tips there for homework too. And I mean some pretty good explanations in my opinion that you might want to check out. And these two tips are included there too. One of the commands that's inside the Windows API, so you don't need to put ITCC in front of it, is called sleep. And the number you put in parentheses there is the number of milliseconds you want the computer to go to sleep. And the computer is just going to sit there when it's in that sleep routine. It's just going to sit there and do nothing for 5 milliseconds. So if your ball's going too fast and you put it in sleep, then it's going to go a little slower. And then finally, a little trick that you can use for now. I hoped to get this working in the framework so that you could use C++ code instead of C code, but this is the C way that you're going to put a variable onto the screen. The %d there in the string player one score corresponds to the value in score player one. And it turns out if you put more %d's in, then each %d corresponds to one variable, so you can tack on more variables there and have it display a lot of stuff at once. So finally, on slide 18, to do, please download the latest framework version from the site and install it. It has a lot of bug fixes, so even if your old framework works and you have it working perfectly and everything, please download and install this new version. And I'm going to be updating this new version. I think you'll find the new version even easier than the older frameworks, because you don't need the DLL file anymore to distribute your stuff. So I think it's all around even a better solution. Secondly, I'm going to post the third homework later on this week. I'm not quite sure what it's going to be yet, but it should be kind of challenging, I hope. I think, actually, that we're going to start building a graphics library that can, for instance, draw a line on the screen, or it can draw pixels, or a lot of different things. And we're going to make this library using functions, and we're going to learn about functions next week. I mainly just included this lecture just to step back a little and to go at a little slower pace so that we could reflect on how a game works, how you might go about starting a game. This lecture is really included to try to catch some people up who weren't able to complete the Pong game, because I do agree that that is a large hurdle for new people to C++, and I hope that this lecture helped. I'll also include some examples of functions and what we've talked about. I'll try to include some more of those examples in the homeworks as well, because that's an important part. And I also encourage all of you, if you're new to C or C++, to pick up a book and read that along with the lectures, because there's only so much stuff I can write out in these lectures, and I can't write out the whole C language. So, I think that's the end of this lecture. Thank you for coming, and I guess we'll answer questions shortly after in the chat room. Thanks a lot for your time.